Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. Thank you for that tremendous episode about the really challenging situation my wife and I find ourselves in with our apartment in the mold. We were both scribbling down notes about H13 grades, HEPA filters, and it was a tremendous overview of what we can do. So really terrific. And I hope that anyone else in Israel or outside of Israel, although the context is a bit different, but sadly, slumlording and treating rental properties as cash cows, as you described it, is a universal tendency among bad landlords. And it's very useful for people to know, especially fellow asthmatics, what they can do for remediation. I want to touch upon a point that you asked, that we discussed in the episode. You mentioned sending a landlord's registered post. In Israel, that's called Doa Rishum, and it's indeed the gold standard for serving legal notice or sending legal correspondence. I actually discovered the last day that the post office allows you to send registered posts entirely online, so you can just type up something. You don't even need to go to the post office, which in Israel is kind of a permanently dysfunctional institution. And while that's the gold standard, people often wonder about other forms of communication, because in the modern world, we don't really send posts that much anymore at all. And in the case of most tenant-landlord interactions, they're going to probably be taking place in Israel 99.9% of the time in WhatsApp groups. And not everyone is going to know that, you know, we hear time and time again, and it's true, and it's important to put things in writing. But I think a lot of people will hear that and say, well, I sent it to him on WhatsApp. My sister is a practicing lawyer in the UK, or a solicitor. I studied law in Ireland, but never practiced. And this question of what form of correspondence is admissible has modernized with the times. In Israel, because WhatsApp is so prevalent, WhatsApp is generally admissible, but certain steps need to be taken to verify the authenticity. We've talked a bunch about stuff like checksums and timestamps, which are best practices in digital evidence. But then again, of course, most people are going to just take a screenshot of WhatsApp and open themselves up to the potential counterclaim that, hey, I never said this. This isn't real. So those episodes, I think, were very important for this reason. But I'd love to ask you, Herman and Corin, about the general principle. Email is one that people often wonder about. If I email my landlord, is that court admissible? Now, people listening to this episode might be in any jurisdiction, and it's going to change. So just as a general principle, and I just want to give a recommendation as well. I discovered a nice service called EEVID, and there's also RPost. And these basically they work by you send it to the recipient plus a recipient address with the suffix. I guess it's not so important exactly the mechanism through which it operates, but basically they relay on the email and calculate the checksum, which I've mentioned before. For those who missed those intriguing episodes, a checksum is basically a mathematical representation of a file. And if you want to prove that a certain file was tamper-proof, that you recorded, if you can prove that you recorded an authentic piece of evidence, whether it's a voice recording or a photograph or a video, and you can calculate the checksum, store it, and later bring that to court, the checksum hasn't changed. It's evidence that it hasn't been digitally manipulated. The first authenticity is evidence that it's not AI generated, because as I mentioned, this is going to be a massive, massive, massive tidal wave of bad faith claims by people saying everything that doesn't suit their interest is AI generated. In other words, deep faking is sadly going to be weaponized. It already is. But those two will get you a long part of the way towards being able to prove a chain of custody. But Herman and Corin, let's talk today about what forms of digital correspondence, if you're advising someone upon they're communicating with their landlord, they might use, or someone else in a legal dispute, they might use registered post for the most important things or as a supplementary layer. But what would you say about the best, the other forms of written communication and what they should do to make sure that they're keeping a proper and well-documented paper trail? Because as you mentioned, documentation is vital in all matters like this. Over to you, Herman and Corin.
So, you're in a standoff with your landlord. Maybe it is about a security deposit that mysteriously vanished, or perhaps it is that mold issue we were talking about recently. You have got the messages, you have got the emails, and you are ready to prove your case. But then the doubt creeps in. Will a judge actually look at a WhatsApp screenshot? What if the other side claims you faked the whole thing with some generative artificial intelligence tool? It is a high-stakes question because in 2026, our entire lives are documented in pixels, yet the legal system is still catching up to how we verify those pixels.
Herman Poppleberry here, and Corn, you are hitting on the exact anxiety of the modern legal era. Our housemate Daniel sent us this prompt because he is navigating these exact waters. He wants to know what forms of digital correspondence are actually court admissible and, more importantly, how we prove they are real. It is one thing to have a paper trail, but in a world where you can fabricate a convincing email thread in 30 seconds, the gold standard for evidence has shifted from what it says to how it was captured.
It is fascinating because we used to rely so much on that physical piece of paper with a signature. Now, Daniel is asking about the digital equivalent of a registered post. We know that in places like Israel, the Dor Rishon, or registered mail, is the traditional way to go. But nobody is sending a physical letter to tell their landlord the sink is leaking. They are sending a text. So, Herman, let us start with the basics. If I have a conversation on WhatsApp or over email, is that technically a legal document?
The short answer is yes, but with a massive asterisk regarding authentication. In most jurisdictions now, including the United States under the Federal Rules of Evidence and the United Kingdom under their Civil Procedure Rules, digital communications are considered documents. They are generally admissible as long as you can prove they are relevant and, crucially, that they are authentic. The problem is that a screenshot is arguably the weakest form of evidence you can bring to court. It is just a flat image. It does not carry the underlying data that proves it was sent from a specific account to another at a specific time.
Right, because I could easily change the name of a contact in my phone to landlord, send myself a message from a different burner phone, and take a screenshot of it. To a judge, that looks like a conversation with my landlord, but it is a total fabrication. So, if a screenshot is the weak link, what is the strong link? How do we move beyond just a picture of a screen?
You have to look at the metadata and the export files. For WhatsApp, for instance, there is a built-in feature to export a chat history. That export creates a text file that includes timestamps and the phone numbers involved. It is much harder to forge than a screenshot, though still not impossible for a determined bad actor. This is where the concept of the chain of custody comes in. Courts are increasingly looking for a way to verify that the digital record has not been altered from the moment it was created to the moment it is presented in court.
I remember we were looking at a case from Canada a while back, the Acta Land and Cattle case. It became quite famous because of a thumbs-up emoji. A grain buyer sent a contract to a farmer via a photo on a messaging app, and the farmer replied with a simple thumbs-up. The court ruled that the emoji constituted a digital signature and a binding contract. What was interesting there was that the Supreme Court of Canada officially declined to hear the appeal in July 2024, which effectively solidified that ruling. It showed that the intent behind the digital communication matters just as much as the format.
Exactly. That case was a landmark because it acknowledged that the way we communicate has fundamentally changed, but it also put everyone on notice. If a thumbs up can cost you $82,000 in damages, you better be sure your digital trail is secure. Daniel asked about checksums and timestamps, and that is where the real technical defense begins. A checksum, for those who might not know, is like a digital fingerprint for a file. If you take an email or a document and run it through a hashing algorithm like SHA-256, it spits out a long string of characters. If even one comma is changed in that document, the checksum will be completely different.
So, if I am a tenant and I want to be proactive, I could theoretically hash my correspondence. That seems a bit technical for the average person. Is there a way to make this practical? If I am sending an email to my landlord saying the roof is leaking, how do I apply a checksum in a way that a court will respect?
This is where those services Daniel mentioned, like EEVID or RPost, come into play. They essentially act as a digital notary. When you use a service like RPost, you are sending what they call a registered email. It is not just an email. It is a service that tracks the delivery, the opening, and the exact content of the message. They provide you with a receipt that includes a cryptographic hash of the entire transaction. If your landlord later claims they never received the email, or that the version you are showing the judge is different from what they received, you produce that receipt. The third-party verification is what carries the weight because it breaks the he-said-she-said dynamic.
I see. So it is about moving the burden of proof. Instead of me trying to prove my screenshot is real, I am presenting a third-party certificate that says this data was frozen in time at 10:15 a.m. on Tuesday. I am curious about EEVs specifically. I have heard they are quite popular in Europe and for international disputes. How do they differ from just BCCing a lawyer or a secondary email address?
BCCing a lawyer does not actually prove content or delivery. It just proves you sent a copy of something to a lawyer. EEVIVI, or Electronic Evidence Provider, creates a certified record of the communication. They use something called a trusted timestamp. This is a sequence of characters that is attached to the data and signed by a timestamping authority. It proves that the data existed at that specific point in time and has not changed since. In many European courts, this is becoming a standard requirement for high-stakes digital evidence. It aligns with the eIDAS regulations, which is the European framework for electronic identification and trust services.
It feels like we are moving toward a world where every interaction needs to be notarized. But let us bring it back to the everyday tenant-landlord relationship. In the United Kingdom, for example, there has been a lot of talk about the Renters' Rights Bill. While it has been winding its way through Parliament, one of the big themes is transparency and the requirement for landlords to provide more material information. If a tenant is relying on these new protections, they need to be able to prove they requested repairs or challenged an unfair rent hike. If they just use standard WhatsApp, are they leaving themselves vulnerable?
They are, especially if the landlord is tech-savvy and knows how to challenge digital evidence. There is a concept called the best evidence rule. Traditionally, this meant you had to provide the original document. In the digital age, what is the original? Is it the data on the server? Is it the phone? Most courts now accept a printout or a digital copy as the original, provided there is no reason to doubt its authenticity. But if a landlord's lawyer stands up and says, "I believe this WhatsApp message was generated by a large language model to look like my client's writing style," the judge has to take that seriously. In 2026, deepfake text is a real thing.
That is a terrifying thought for a tenant. You have a legitimate grievance, but it gets dismissed because the technology to fake it is so ubiquitous that the evidence itself becomes suspect. It is like a reverse, crying, wolf situation. The existence of fakes makes the truth harder to verify. You mentioned the EU AI Act earlier. Does that play into how courts view digital evidence now?
It does, indirectly. The EU AI Act, which has various tiers of implementation with general obligations really kicking in this year in August 2026 and more for high-risk systems in 2027, focuses heavily on transparency. It mandates that AI-generated content be labeled. While that is great for social media, it does not stop a malicious actor from using AI to forge an email and stripping the label. However, it has made judges and legal professionals much more aware of the risks. We are seeing a shift where courts are starting to prefer evidence that comes with a verifiable provenance. This is where C2PA comes in.
C2PA? That is the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, right? We have talked about them in relation to photos and videos, proving that a news photo hasn't been photoshopped. Are you saying that is coming to text and email too?
It is beginning to. The idea is to have metadata baked into the file at the moment of creation that tracks its history. If you take a photo of a broken pipe in your apartment, a C2PA-enabled camera app would sign that photo with a cryptographic key, proving it was taken at your GPS coordinates at a specific time and has not been altered. If you then send that photo to your landlord, you are sending a piece of evidence with an unbreakable seal. While it is not a de facto legal requirement yet in 26, it is absolutely where the industry is heading. If you are a tenant today, using an app that supports these standards is like having a private investigator standing over your shoulder.
I love that analogy. It is about building a fortress around your facts. But let us talk about the other side of the coin. What about the landlord who claims they sent a notice via email, but the tenant says it went to spam or they never saw it? In the UK, there was a mandate about material information in property listings that came from the National Trading Standards. It requires very specific disclosures. If a landlord claims they disclosed a property defect via email, but the tenant disputes it, how does the court handle that?
This is where our post really shines. They have a feature called Registered Receipt, which provides legal proof of delivery. Not just that it was sent, but that it was delivered to the recipient's mail server. In many jurisdictions, once it hits the server, it is legally considered served. This prevents the "I didn't see it" defense. For a tenant, if your lease says that notices must be given in writing, you should clarify if digital counts. Many older leases specify registered post, which traditionally meant the physical mail, but modern courts are increasingly interpreting in writing to include email, provided there is a reliable way to verify it.
So a proactive tenant might actually want to send a formal email through one of these services, even if they already sent a WhatsApp, just to have that registered status in their back pocket. It is almost like a belt and suspenders approach. You have the casual conversation on WhatsApp for speed, but the formal, "I am serious," noticed via a certified service.
Exactly. And let us not forget about the role of the platform itself. Some people think that if they delete a message on their end, it disappears forever. But in a legal dispute, a court can order a forensic download of a device. Even deleted messages can often be recovered by experts. So, the advice is always, act as if every digital word you type will be read aloud by a judge. Don't be aggressive, don't be vague, and don't delete.
That is a great rule of thumb. Would I want a judge to read this? It is a good filter for life, honestly. But back to Daniel's specific question about documentation. If someone cannot afford a premium service like our post, what is the poor man's version of a reliable paper trail? Is there a way to use standard tools more effectively?
There is. First, stop using screenshots as your primary record. Use the export chat function in your messaging apps. This preserves more metadata. Second, for emails, save them as .eml files rather than just printing them to PDF. An EML file contains the full header information, including the IP addresses of the servers it passed through, that is, the DNA of an email. If a forensic expert needs to verify it, they need those headers. Third, use a cloud backup service that has versioning. If you have a log of your interactions in a Google Doc or a Word file, the version history proves that you didn't just write the whole thing yesterday.
That version history is a big one. It shows a timeline of creation. I also think it is worth mentioning that in some places, like Israel, the courts have been quite progressive about accepting digital evidence, but they are also very strict about the privacy protection law. If you are recording a phone call with your landlord, in many places you can do that as long as one party, you, consents. But if you are sharing that recording, you have to be careful.
That is a crucial point, Korn. Admissibility is not just about authenticity, it is also about legality. If you obtain the evidence in a way that violates privacy laws, a judge might throw it out regardless of how true it is. In Israel, for instance, the Supreme Court has had several rulings over the last few years emphasizing that while digital life is open, the right to privacy remains a fundamental pillar. You cannot just hack into someone's account to prove they lied to you. The evidence has to be clean.
It is a delicate balance. You want to protect yourself, but you have to play by the rules of the forum you're in. I am thinking about the virtual verbal communications idea. There was a lot of debate recently about whether a WhatsApp message is more like a phone call, which is transient, or a letter, which is permanent. The consensus seems to be that it is a hybrid, but the law is leaning toward treating it as a permanent record.
It really is, and that is why the paper trail Daniel mentioned is so vital. Even if it is a digital paper trail, it needs to have the same qualities as paper. It must be readable, it must be persistent, and it must be attributable to a specific person. When you use a service like our post, you are essentially adding a digital seal to that persistence. They have been around for a long time, and while they are often used by big legal firms, they have accessible tiers for individuals. They focus on the legal proof aspect, which is different from just security.
Right. Encryption makes things private, but it doesn't necessarily make them proven. You can have an encrypted message that is still a lie. We need to distinguish between the content being secure and the delivery being verified. So, if we look at the practical takeaways here for Daniel, or anyone in a similar spot, it seems like the first step is to check the lease. See what it says about notices. If it is old-fashioned, you might actually need that physical registered mail to be safe.
Definitely. If the lease says notice must be served by registered post to the landlord's registered office, then an email might not count, no matter how many checksums you have. But, and this is a big but, if you have a history of communicating via email and the landlord has responded to those emails in the past, a court might rule that the landlord has waived the requirement for physical mail through their conduct. This is why keeping that history is so important. It proves the established pattern of communication.
That is a great point. The established pattern can often override the strict letter of a contract if both parties have been ignoring that letter for months. If you have been paying rent via an app and discussing repairs via WhatsApp for a year, the landlord is going to have a hard time arguing in court that they don't recognize WhatsApp as a valid form of communication.
Exactly. It is about the reasonable expectation of the parties involved, but don't rely on that if you can avoid it. If you are about to head into a real dispute, start moving your communication to more formal channels. Send a summary email after a WhatsApp call. As we discussed on our WhatsApp call at 2 p.m. today, you agreed to fix the boiler by Friday. Now you have moved that verbal or semi-verbal agreement into a dated, time-stamped email. If you use a service like EEVID for that summary, you have just created a very powerful piece of evidence.
It feels like the digital age has made us all our own paralegals. You have to be so diligent. I wonder, Herman, do you think we will ever reach a point where the platforms themselves provide this court-ready export as a standard feature, like a legal export button in WhatsApp?
I think we are seeing the beginning of that with the privacy reports and data downloads that the GDPR and other regulations have forced on big tech. But the platforms are wary of liability. They don't want to be the ones certifying that a message is true. They just provide the data. The certification will likely always remain with third-party services or forensic experts who can testify to the integrity of the data.
It is a good business to be in right now, I imagine. Digital forensics is only going to grow. Before we wrap this part up, I want to touch on one more thing Daniel asked about, timestamps. We often take them for granted, but how easy are they to manipulate? If I change the clock on my computer and send an email, does that work?
Not really. Your computer's internal clock is one thing, but the mail server's clock is another. Every email header contains a receive tag from every server it touched. Those servers use atomic clocks and network time protocol to stay synchronized. A forensic expert can look at the headers and see that while your computer claimed it was 1999, the Google or Microsoft servers recorded it as 2026. This is why saving the original file, the EML or the full header, is so much better than a PDF. The PDF only shows what was on the screen. The EML shows the truth from the servers.
That is the aha moment right there. The screen is a lie, but the headers don't lie. Or at least they are much harder to coach into lying. So, for Daniel, the advice is, keep the raw data. Don't just rely on what you see. Use the tools available to freeze that data in time.
And if the dispute is over a significant amount of money or your home, it is worth the $20 or whatever it costs to use a professional service for the most important notices. It is a small price to pay for peace of mind.
Absolutely. This has been a deep dive into the guts of digital evidence. It is a bit nerdy, but it is the kind of nerdiness that saves you in court. Herman, I think we've given Daniel a lot to chew on.
I hope so. It is a complex field, and it is changing every month as new precedents are set. But the core principle remains: document everything, verify through third parties when possible, and never assume a screenshot is enough.
Well said. And hey, if you are listening and you have found this useful, or if you have your own weird prompt about legal tech or anything else, we would love to hear from you. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. There is a contact form there, and you can also find our full archive of episodes.
Yeah, we have covered everything from mold to the mechanics of the internet. If you have been enjoying the show, a quick review on your podcast app or a rating on Spotify really helps us out. It helps other curious people find the show.
It really does. We appreciate all of you who have been with us for the long haul. We are approaching episode 400, which feels a bit surreal, doesn't it, Herman?
It does. We have come a long way from just chatting in our kitchen in Jerusalem. Thanks to Daniel for keeping us on our toes with these prompts.
Definitely. Thanks, Daniel. And thanks to all of you for listening. We will be back soon with another deep dive into the weird and wonderful questions you send our way.
Stay curious and keep those digital trails clean. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Take care, everyone. See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.